Season 5 of the Telly Award Winning Podcast. Coming at you like the tough and incorruptible New York City Police Lieutenant Theopolis Kojak, sucking on a dum-dum, demanding that you quit your belly aching, asking the one question everybody wants to hear. Who loves you, baby?
Who loves you, baby?
Good biblical Theopolis. You know, the Gospel of Luke and the Acts of the Apostles were addressed to him. I forget that. Like, I know it. He goes by Theo. Back to Kojak more than anything. But yeah, Theopolis, his government.
And there was a fun reboot with Ving Rhames.
Yeah, yeah. It was good.
Ving Rhames, the thinking man's Telly Savalas, I guess. I don't know. But he was fun.
Hard to argue with Ving Rhames in anything. I am Rylan Grant.
By the way, Irving Rhames. Irving Rhames, his college roommate Stanley Tucci.
Yeah,
wow. Was okay. The one that called him Ving. Just a little Irving Rhames trivia for the kids at home.
Wow, speaking of government, yeah. All right. Well, you know, here's the thing: is we teach you something every time you listen or watch.
You're always learning.
So tune in. We got more of this stuff. It's just sitting in the holster. We're gonna fire away at you. I think Grant, speaking of government, screenwriter, Ving Rhames fan, Irving Rhames fan, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant Banjax, The Jump, and now The Breach, which is only available on Kickstarter. It's on Kickstarter right now. We'll talk more about that in a minute. The other voice in the dark, the man in the box to the left this time, is...
David Avalone, writer of comics and TV and things, and coffee achiever, and stuff like that there.
Rock and roll. If you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Casman, Ray Barnes, and many more, our entire catalog can be celebrated via YouTube, Apple Pods, and other purveyors of worthwhile ear cracks, so double on back and check it all out. A little warning at the beginning. I am suffering from COVID right now, so I am fighting through.
Not the big.
But if I'm see me limping, that is why. We should talk about what we have to promote before we promote our stuff. Like, we have a million friends that have a million great things going on.
That
so
is true.
Our good friend Chris Longo, who we had on a week or two ago, they just launched their Welcome to Panic starter pack on Zoop.
Panic with a K, so you know it's funny.
Panic with K, exactly, and it's three really great horror comics from some really interesting creators. So so check that out. I backed that first thing. Our friends at Fanbase Press launched their very first Kickstarter for their
Ripple Effect.
A deluxe edition of their Eisner-nominated Jordan Hart opus, Ripple Effects, which is really good. I'm sure Richard Fairgray has like two or three things going on Kickstarter right now, so check out what he has going on. And when this airs, I will be a little under a week from launching my new title. It is a Black Mirror-esque sci-fi joint called The Breach. Maybe the best thing I've done. Thinking man sci-fi and jeans, about a border town that you're dealing with smugglers for the Alaska Russian border, but then these portals, these breaches appear that are a border to some other place in time, and evil and awful starts coming through, and I'm blinking out here in the video, but evil starting through and the kind of the scumbags, the dirtbags, the spoilers are all that are standing between us and total annihilation. It's a good story, a lot of fun, a sort of No Country for Old Men meets Independence Day, that sort of thing, you know, big and bad and small and quaint, colliding in a really interesting way. So go check it out. I'm proud of it. I think you're gonna love it. You can follow the Kickstarter page right now, and we'll go live on Monday, the 23rd of September. So
nice.
You're up. What do you have to promote, Avalone, before we bring our...
Well, I got Drawing Blood number 5, my series from Image Comics, with co-created with Kevin Eastman, art by Ben Bishop from The Last Ronin and other fine comics. It's about the life of a comic book creator, not unlike Kevin's, who creates a very popular billion-dollar global franchise in his living room with his brother, and then finds his life spinning wildly out of control because early success is a roller coaster and there are lots of ups and downs. And we pick him up sort of in middle age trying to recover from one of those big downs. We're five issues in. The very well-reviewed first volume trade paperback should be in bookstores very soon. Drawing Blood Volume 1 called Spilled Ink. Issue 6 will be out at the end of September. And I have 3 weekends of upcoming personal appearances on the block. I'll be at Granite State. When this goes live, I'll be at Granite State Comic Con this weekend, which, should you be anywhere near Manchester, New Hampshire, come on by. It's a very Turtles Eastman-centric con. A lot of people from Ninja Turtles history will be there, voice actors, people who are in the 1990 movie, things like that. And the weekend after that, I'll be doing an appearance at Arsenal Comics and Games in Newhall Park in Southern California. And then the weekend after that, first weekend in October, I will be at good old LA Comic Con with the rest of the LA independent comic scene, trying to make something at LA Comic Con one more time. But that'll be fun. I'll have a table.
I guess I should figure out being at LA Comic Con. I have not thought about that. The funny thing is, I was at the Long Beach International Karate Tournament a couple of weeks ago, and you know, a lot of like martial arts stars there, signing autographs and meeting fans, guys from Karate Kid and Cynthia Rothrock and stuff like that. But the guys who were in the turtle suits in that original, you know, 1990s turtle movies are there, right, signing autographs like crazy. But they're standing there at a con table in the turtle suit. It's like the full turtle suit, the head, wow, is off, it's on the table. You know, they'll put it on for pictures, yeah, and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but they're standing there in the suit, and it's like old and ragged, and they're yeah, signing pictures of, you know, themselves in a Donatello costume or something like that. It was pretty cool. I was like, oh wow, that's something I haven't seen before. So I'm sure you will see the same thing at the Granite State
Con. Yes, we will see some, yeah, of those kids. But let us bring in our guest, yeah, Sean Hainsworth. Here he comes.
Hello.
Howdy, howdy.
Sean, welcome to the show. Tell the kids at home a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Sean Hainsworth. I am the publisher of SHB Comics. I also write under the pen name Darren Escape. I got 2 titles in comic book stores now, another Thinking Man sci-fi, a Thinking Man's military sci-fi called The Killing Machine, a comedy of horrors about a vampire that goes to Woodstock in 1969 called Woodsteak. And, next year we've got Aerotech, which is a story about a Silicon Valley startup that makes sex robots that need more debugging. So those are my titles. And we got three more in production, but they're a ways out. Those are the 3 we're talking about now.
Sure. And if I remember correctly, like me and Ryland, you come at this from the film end originally, right? That was your first career, or your, I don't know how many before that, but was that your first love?
I was going to say define career. Yeah. Love, sure. For sure. Yeah. So I actually started out as a documentary filmmaker. I made like 5 feature-length documentaries back in the 90s. And then started, you know, writing, had always been writing stories, wrote The Killing Machine as a novel initially. And then at a certain point, I was at the Austin Film Festival with Woodsteak as a screenplay. And I just had the revelation that this sucks. Like, you know, like being a screenwriter, you have no agency. You're just hoping that someone will take your screenplay and do whatever they want with it. And you have no control over that. And so I decided I was just going to make it myself. And so, yeah, that's how it all started. And I'm just having a ton of fun now and no looking back, like really thoroughly enjoying the creative process of working with, you know, it's a different artist on each series, but bringing these things to life as opposed to just, you know, writing screenplays that you fire off into the ether. And, you know, screenplays have a very short shelf life, as you know, like 6 months. And if someone doesn't want to option it in that time period, there's an avalanche of new screenplays. So tough business. But yes, yeah, I do love film.
Interesting trivia. Sean's name is actually LaShawn, but he was rooming with Stanley Tucci one day, and decided to call him Sean. It is this interesting thing, Sean. You know, we all share this film background, and we all share, you know, similar frustrations, you know, the filmic gatekeepers and stuff like that. And we've talked at length on the show about how a film education and a film skill set transfers so readily to comic books. It is a visual storytelling medium. And it is this thing, if you look at any of my comic books, I treat them all as little films I'm directing. They all say written and directed by Rylan Grant. a very similar thing. I think what you were talking about was true 10 years ago. I think it's never been more true than it is today. I feel like it gets more and more true every day. Fewer and fewer things being made, and a good story is a good story. I mean, I start writing something now, and I don't know what it is. You know, I generally start writing in screenplay format, just because like I've written in screenplay format forever, so things come out very naturally and very easily for me. But at some point, I need to stop and then figure out what it is. And the most recent thing I was writing, it's a heist thing that has kind of an interesting twist on it. And I just started writing it in the screenplay format, and I got to, I don't know, about page 55 or so. And I'm like, okay, I think it's maybe time to stop and put the brakes on and feel what this actually is. And so I'm looking at this thing, and I'm like, okay, did I just write the first half of a movie? Did I just write, you know, the pilot episode of, let's say, like an 8-episode mini for TV? Or did I write the first couple of issues of a comic book series? Did I write the first few chapters of a novel? I don't know. I wrote a good story. I did a good world. I like these characters. I want to see where these characters are going. And I actually had to send it to my manager and be like, hey, what is this? You know, and part of that ends up being like, where's the opportunity? Yeah. Well, and part of it ends up being like, where's the opportunity? It's like, well, you know, somebody's looking for this on TV right now. So, you know, make a few adjustments and let's commit to that. And then it becomes, and then becomes the process of it actually becoming a TV thing, as opposed to just this piece of marble that you shut out. But I think it's interesting. I mean, we are in this era of this convention, and I think that, I went to the American Film Institute Conservatory with a lot of really talented people who washed out because they could not ride the waves of this business, and they were screenwriters. When it got hard to be a screenwriter, they stayed screenwriters. And those of us who survived, we became writers, creators of other things, you know? And so it is not enough anymore to be a screenwriter. You also have to be a prose writer, a novelist, a short story writer, a comic writer. You'd be able to just create stories, tell stories in all of these different mediums that you survive. And the irony is like, you know, you write a short story, and then Hollywood is tripping over themselves, fighting over it, right? You get a bidding war with a short story when nobody would have touched the screenplay with a 10-foot pole. So I don't know. I think it's interesting you coming in with, some sort of like similar experiences here.
So I'm interested in what was the step-by-step with Woodstake? You leave Austin, or was that where you were?
Austin. Yeah, it was Austin.
You leave Austin, you go home. What's step one?
Yeah. So step one was, find an artist. Obviously I cannot draw. It's a visual medium. So I got really lucky because at that point I knew absolutely nothing. But one thing I will say, just a general observation, the comic book industry or the comic book community is so much more welcoming and supportive of different voices and different people, and the barrier to entry is lower, and people are just a whole lot nicer and friendlier. You know, Hollywood can be, very different than that. And so I also felt kind of a comfortable home in this world. And I got a lot of good advice, but I ended up finding this guy named Felipe Kroll online, just kind of, you know, looking around at portfolios and different things. And he had a really unique style. He had done some, you know, characters and scenes from The Sandman, just as you know, kind of, you know, exercises to show off his prowess. Yeah. And so we just kind of hit it off. And, at that point it was trying to figure out how to, tell the story in a different medium. Right. So, I mean, one of the things I'm sure you've struggled with is that, you know, typically in a screenplay, they want a three act structure. People want a three act structure. Right. But I envision this as it ended up being six issues. And so each issue has its own structure and it doesn't fall into the same kind of narrative, structure. But what's great, what I find really great, is when you write things for different mediums, you refine them and you see them from a different angle. Like I had written the screenplay of Woodstake like 8 times. And I was like, this is it. I can't do any more. This is the best screenplay I can write. And then I started writing as a graphic novel. And I was like, oh, that's weak. I could improve that. You know, once you take a different perspective, you see it differently. And so really, yeah, that was the step-by-step. And I learned as I went initially, like the first issue of Woodstake. Part of the problem was Woodstake is a great idea, right? It's a very easy idea. It's got a great elevator pitch. Immediately, all the comic scenes with vampires and hippies came to me. But then you got to tell a real story with real characters. And you also have to answer the question of, why is there a vampire in upstate New York in 1969? You know, and I had always been I'm a huge kind of Bram Stoker Dracula guy. That's the vampire mythology that resonates most with me. And so I brought over, you know, kind of extended a Bram Stoker type Dracula into the new world in the 1920s. And I had this prologue that set up what was going on in the 60s. And initially those two were slammed into the first issue. And I felt like that, you know, when I got that first issue out, we did a crowdfunding campaign. We did fine. I shipped them out. But as I looked at it, I thought, you know what, this prologue needs more. It needs to live and breathe on its own. So I actually broke it out and developed that, what was originally like 8 pages in the original, as a 20-page prologue. I gave it, you know, the full weight of what I felt like it needed. And then that allowed me to stretch out and refine issue one a little bit. So, you know, really, I learned as I went. And I wasn't afraid to say, I can make this better. You know, I wasn't afraid to say, I'm going to spend more money and go back and build out some more pages. You know, the process all the way along was, how do I tell the best story that I can tell? Right. And so, yeah, I'm really, really pleased with the way it's come out. I'm just proofing the final issue right now. The first issue is on shelves and the next one's coming out. So it'll be every month through December. Philippe and I are already working on, Woodstake 99, you know, so it's going to have a sequel in 1999 because the 99 Woodstake was extremely different than 1969 and much more conducive to a vampire. And so I decided to tell the story in two parts. So it will end in Woodstake 99, but that's what we're working on now.
Special appearance by Fred Durst.
One thing I'm curious, I wasn't clear in that narrative is, so you did a Kickstarter issue one, and then you revised that and did a different issue one for Diamond?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. What was great was, my local comic book shop, got a great owner, really nice guy. I've known him for a long time. And so I was selling the first issue ones there, just going there and selling and talking to his customers. And so what was great is I really got some feedback, right? Some reader feedback. And I was really able to, you know, after 6 months of that first issue being out, you know, really clarify my ideas on how I could make it better. And so, it was a question of doing that first, you know, Kickstarter, getting a lot of feedback and also just getting more experience in the medium. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's everything's a learning process. Right. Every medium is very different. It's also learning how to work with the artist that's drawing it and giving him, in this case, as much space as possible to invent, because it really is a collaboration. Now it's like we've got a really nice shorthand and we really are working well together now. So I think that's good. And his painting style has also evolved. It's kind of fun. Like he's really developing his skills as an artist. He's got a great style, but it's evolving. So if you go from Woodstake 1 to the Woodstake 5, you're going to see the art really change in some really interesting ways.
And they're painted comics.
They are. Yeah. Wow.
That's a, yeah. that is a high level of effort.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. He does digital painting. And the other thing is he does some initial 3D models before he paints.
Oh, interesting.
And what's fun about that is that I will send him storyboards with camera angles in a way, because once he's got the 3D model, we can actually move things around a little bit. And So, talking about written and directed by, you know, it is fun to go back on that initial sketches and be like, hey, what if we came up a little higher on this, a little bit more from behind the characters or whatever. And he can actually do that. The 3D models are pretty rough, and most of the work is done in the painting, but at least in terms of the layout of the scene and stuff, it was fun to do that.
Sure. Now, you said you went to Kickstarter for the first issue. Did you have prior experience with Kickstarter for short films, or was this your first ever Kickstarter thing?
That was my first ever Kickstarter. Actually, my first ever Kickstarter. And I really learned as I went. I mean, that was a lot of friends and family getting me over the finish line, learning how it works, learning, you know, how to handle analytics and learning how to, you know, how to just try to promote this thing. So, you know, I've had several Kickstarters since then. I did one called Aliens, Vampires, and Sex Robots, where I did issues of all three stories. Because I also view Kickstarters as not ends within themselves, but as audience building, right?
Sure.
Everybody who contributes or backs a campaign is a potential fan, and a potential fan that will come back, and a potential fan that may, you know, someone who likes Woodstape may like Aerotech, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, we've really, really learned a lot about this whole thing. We're planning a Kickstarter for next year that I think, is going to take a lot of the lessons that we learned, and hopefully we're going to be able to really, you know, break out a little bit more with our Kickstarter next year, but we shall see.
And is Aerotech, connected to, I saw something, you had a film about a robot that you'd previously done.
Yeah. So I did, Aerotech started out as a short story that was kind of from the customer's perspective. It started as sort of an unboxing video for a robot, robot that then misbehaves and he has to call customer support. So I did that. That's outside of the main Aerotech narrative. So Aerotech is about the company, and it's an office comedy about the company that makes the sex robots. But we did the short unboxing customer story as a separate one-off story, and then I took that and I produced it as a film, short film, because I just felt like that was such a tight little story and it really worked. And there's an actress we found named Courtney Paroso who does a sex robot stage show, and she's just tremendous. We did make a short film, and it's been doing really well at the festivals. We've been in, I think, like 27 festivals.
Oh, that's great.
And so I don't know where that's going to take us in the end, but once again, a different media, getting different kinds of press attention, all things are good if they move us forward.
And it's something that you can, you know, having a good piece of video is pretty great in a Kickstarter campaign, you know?
Yeah, it's an 8-minute video too. It's a low lift for anybody, you know? It's an 8-minute sex robot comedy. It's hard to, you know, hard to find.
I remember the Wild West days of video online when 8 minutes was the limit.
Yes.
8 minutes was the longest a QuickTime video could actually be. And I think Real Player could be 9 minutes, but then you couldn't also have it in QuickTime.
I know.
Those years are long. But also I remember reading in the early aughts, someone did some sort of analytic thing online, even after you could make QuickTimes longer, where they said 8 minutes is the absolute longest anyone will ever watch a movie on the internet.
Yeah. Well, and now it's 20. I put 20-second things up on, you know, social media. My daughter's like, these are boring. These are boring.
Yeah. These are too long.
Now it's like 2 seconds is too long, right?
So,
I remember the Real Player really well and all of that. And actually, when I edited back in the old days, you just getting the hard drives that could handle your video for nonlinear editing was a big deal. You know, getting these big RAID drives, everything was expensive. It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't think I have it anymore, but I used to teach film editing, nonlinear film editing. And I used to have, just as a thing to shock everyone under the age of 30, a 2 gig drive that was the size of a masonry brick.
Yeah.
And heavier, actually, than a masonry brick. And it was something I had pulled out of a computer. I pulled it out of a computer to send it in to get it replaced by warranty. And by the time they sent me the replacement drive, the machine was hopelessly outdated and it was all, you know, 1,000 times better and all of that. But that's a whole, I started on the D-Vision system and I think I had a blazing eight gigs of storage, which was just unthinkable.
Yeah.
That was just an unthinkable amount of storage and I could cut an entire feature film on it. And those days are now, you know, 8 gigs is now one shot on a RED camera, I think. So it's a things are a little different now. But yeah, so you are continuing to use the Kickstarter model even as you're putting comics through the Diamond system.
Yeah, and actually it's interesting because I was actually speaking to Chris Longo about this, and he was saying, you know, Diamond did not used to really like when people were doing Kickstarters. Now they have no problem with it. Like, I think once again, everything is evolving and Kickstarter is just, or crowdfunding is just a part of the mix now. I was on a panel at San Diego, a crowdfunding panel with, you know, Jordan from Zoop and somebody from Kickstarter. And it's just now really standard, right? I mean, it's just, and that's the thing, as an independent publisher, you really have to cobble together your market. It's like Diamond is not, you know, distribution of comic book stores is not going to pay for a comic, right?
Well, and Diamond is only 1/3 of distribution to comic book stores too. There's exactly. That you got, you know, it's funny. It kind of tickled us that they didn't bring it up in negotiations, but my comic that is now with Image, literally our first issue dropped the month they went to Lunar and dropped Diamond. It was just one of those things where I had a chart with all of the Diamond due dates on it. And I was like, none of this is now relevant to the future of this comic with Image. And Image, God bless them. I think it's partially because they're used to dealing with people who are not full-time comic book, have worked for DC, have worked for Marvel kind of people. They really have very early deadlines for Lunar. Like there's a month of fudge in their deadlines, which I think is good.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The more people are going to be, because they know that people, and particularly the people they're dealing with, are going to be late. They're going to be late as hell, you know, and we have to, you know, they have to make up for that. And, you know, so it's an interesting, but it's been interesting, like, for my ego, like, as much as I like being in the Lunar catalog, the fact that it's not a physical object that I can walk into a comic book store and look and show it to the comic book store owner and go, look, Mike, here's my comic. You should buy this. It's an adjustment.
Yeah. Everything is moving so fast and you just don't know. I mean, like, establishing a relationship with Diamond takes a huge amount of work, right? So I spent a lot of time and effort and working out our processes and everything else. And it's like, and then I have, you know, a retailer say, I don't deal with Diamond anymore, or all the retailers in Canada saying they charge me too much for shipping. Whereas, you know, Penguin Random House will ship for free in Canada and Lunar, you know, so now it's like, do you spend the time to establish relationships with multiple distributors? Yep. And, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard. You're just trying to cobble together your audience where you can find it. But crowdfunding is a big part of that, right? And then digital, you know, we're on Global Comics, we're starting there is part of it. And somehow you're trying to cobble together all the pieces to get this thing out there. It's a lot of work. Yeah.
And and that was the other, you know, another thing to talk about is, when did you decide to self-publish and what were the, you know, when did you decide to become a publisher and what part of the process was that for you?
Yeah, I think for me it was not having worked for Marvel or DC, coming from a different world. I really felt like I needed to fully do and understand this, right? And make it my own and make the decisions for my books initially. The last thing I wanted to do was, you know, give the book to somebody else and then have to sit back and be like, well, they're not promoting it enough, or well, they're not doing this, or well, they're not doing that, right? You know, I looked at you know, Scout, places that were acquiring comics, but you know, at the end of the day, then you don't have the agency, right? And that's really what I wanted, was the agency to produce my own books and get them out in the world. So, you know, maybe in a few years, if we're, you know, successful, and there's an opportunity to partner up or to put them through Image or to put them to somewhere else, that would be great. But I will also have acquired all the knowledge along the way that I can make intelligent decisions and interact with them well, right? Like, to not be the total noob, to know what I'm getting into, what I need to ask for, how I need to follow the process, you know, all of that. So it was really just a question of, I've got to learn how to do this. And so I'm going to do it.
Yeah, we self-published Drawing Blood before it got picked up by Image. I mean, Image picked it up 2-3 years later, if not more. And I always try to, I tell people, at least do the research on self-publishing, because you should know pluses and negatives of what publishers are up against. You know, some people get pretty mad about the bite that publishers take out of your profits. And I'm like, if you've self-published, you will find out how razor thin the margins are on profitability on a floppy in a comic book store.
Yeah.
And, you know, not to say, oh, we should all pity the poor publishers, but you should know what the break-even point is. You should know X amount of floppies. I should not be surprised if there's no royalty when Image only sells 3,000 floppies. I should understand that they just lost some money on me.
Yeah.
You know, and where the line of profitability is for you and all of that kind of thing. And how many comics just don't end up making money? I mean, I used to, when Comicron actually had all the information, now because it's not all diamond, Comicron is functionally useless. But it would always shock me when I would have like an Elvira comic out and it would be like the 87th highest selling comic that month. And I would look from 88 down and I'm seeing like Marvel and DC titles in there. And I'm just going, they like Dynamite made some good money on my Elvira comic, but 20 down in the list, I'm seeing Marvel and DC losing money on brand name characters about whom feature films that have grossed zillions of dollars have been made. And it's fascinating. Like when you see yourself outselling, you know, a ninth tier Marvel comic, you go, oh, those are interesting economics. Like to find out, oh, Marvel's losing money on that book. DC's losing money on that book. And I know, because I know where I lost money and got money. You know, and knowing what the profitability on a trade is and what the number is there. It's really, really, you know, I think as much as creators don't want to become businessmen, I think particularly in comic books, man, you really got to know. Like it really.
Well, yeah. And now more than ever. I mean, we talked about this with Chris Longo, you know, and it is very difficult to make money putting comic books in comic shops, right? I mean, right now, that is just that's why publishers are going under. It is hard enough for a publisher with some momentum, the Aftershocks of the world, to make money putting comic books in comic shops. It is extremely hard for a creator who has handed their book off to somebody else to make any money doing that. You know, books cost a lot of time, a lot of money to make, right? And so... we have to fight the battle on all fronts, and that's what it sounds like Sean is doing. And you do have crowdfunding. You do have, I mean, Rare Grade is a lot of money selling books at cons. You know, it's not something I do. It's something he is really good at. It's something Ray Anthony Height is very good at. You know, you see these guys doing it. But it's a blessing and a curse. It's a lot of work. Fight the battle on all fronts, right? It's very difficult.
Yeah.
However, it did not used to be possible for us to make a dollar and a quarter out of this stuff, and now we can. Now it's in our hands. I can I can put a book on Kickstarter, and I make a pretty good chunk of change, you know, and it makes it worth it for me to do. It makes it possible for me to pay artists what they deserve. And it keeps me coming back. Right. So that's interesting. And so, I mean, there are opportunities, in all these different corners. And as a creator right now, if you are not exploring all of these opportunities, if you're not fighting the battle on all these fronts, then you're leaving money on the table, you're leaving fans on the table, exposure on the table, all that stuff, right? Your book is not getting into all the hands that it should be getting into. And, you know, that may, you know, right book gets in the right person's hand and that may change everything, right? So,
yeah that's moving. It. You have to view it, I mean, you know, as you said, there are books that are profitable and books that are not profitable. And not all books are going to be profitable. And you know, the one that you love the most may not be profitable, right? And you do have to run it as a business. But, you know, the other thing is, like you said, is for me, what I'm also doing is establishing intellectual property, right? Like, this is the big thing. Because as a screenwriter, you pretty much generally have to give it away when you sell a screenplay, right? I mean, you even look at, you know, Stallone had to give up the rights to the characters on Rocky when Rocky was made. And now he sits back and cringes as they keep extending these characters out. And he has no control over what they do with them, right? Establishing your intellectual property is really important because then you can go cross medium. And like, you know, like you said, the right thing gets in the right hands at the right time. And maybe that hits, and that allows you to make a whole bunch of other books, right, that you want to make that may not hit. Because also, like you, I always want to pay the artist. The risk is mine, right? I'm not asking artists to take that risk because it's hard. It's really hard to make a living as an artist, right? Mm-hmm. So I really try to pay my artists well and take on that risk and believing that cobbling together sales, getting things out there, establishing the intellectual property, you're going to hit at some point in time, hopefully.
Yeah.
Somewhere.
I mean, and even before I was in comics, I always said, like, a successful career in show business, and, you know, the chaos of my IMDb page reflects this, but, you know, you really don't want to leave any money on the table or any opportunities on the table, and it's best. You know, I have always maintained, and there's a lot of gatekeepers who disagree with this, that storytelling is the art and the rest of it is all craft. Film editing, there are tricks and tips to film editing. There are tips and tricks to cinematography. These are crafts that need to be studied for years to become excellent at them. But if you know the basic tools of storytelling, you understand the hard part about them. You understand the part that can't be taught, no matter how hard. If you don't understand story, you're never going to be a great film editor, no matter how much you understand how an Avid works and, you know, how to make a trim and all of that kind of stuff. It's all of that is secondary. So I always tried to learn anything I could about any corner of storytelling. One, as an abject way to make a buck, you know, like, this is something I can get paid for, I might as well do it. But two, I think it all feeds it. And I, you know, if you're a better comic book writer if you understand what the artist is doing and why they're doing it than if you simply go like, oh, this page looks nice. You know,
I agree. I think it's all storytelling, honestly, at the end of the day. And the other thing is, storytelling is really hard, right? Your 10th draft may be good, but it's the 20th draft or the 25th draft where you really nail the story, right? And I actually find, I watch a lot of films these days and I'm like, wow, like, so much money, so much production value went into this and the script needed 10 more drafts because it's a great idea. But they hadn't quite got there yet, right? Like, you can't
either the script had 10 too many drafts.
Like, knowing where it's right is really, really hard. But at the end of the day, if you don't have that, it doesn't matter. Nothing else matters, honestly.
Well, I saw someone on Instagram. This became a very popular comment of mine that got a zillion likes, which is funny to me. But some account on Instagram was talking about, you know, why is Spider-Man 3 so bad? It's still Sam Raimi. It's still Tobey Maguire. And I was like, And it's none of the screenwriters from the first two movies. And the fact that that wasn't part of your, it's baffling why this movie is so bad. It's like the people who were, Tobey Maguire and Sam Raimi can do a lot in bringing Spider-Man to life and the camera being in the right place and the pacing of a scene being correct and the compositions being great. But there's that other part they can't do. And when you don't bring back the people who wrote the first two films, you're taking a pretty huge gamble that your movie's going to suck. I was watching the opening. I thought Wonder Woman 84 had one of the best trailers I've ever seen in my life. And I'm watching the opening credits, and I apologize for not remembering the guy's name, but I'm watching the opening credits, and it's a good opening credit sequence, and it says screenplay by, and the guy who wrote Wonder Woman was not there. Patty Jenkins was there and Zack Snyder was there, but the guy who actually wrote the script for the first movie was not brought back. And I went, well, now I know this is going to probably not be good because they didn't want to bring back the guy who was actually, like, yes, Gal Gadot is charming and beautiful and does great in action sequences and everybody likes looking at Chris Pine and he's charming as hell and Pedro Pascal and all that, but the lack of respect for, I mean, you know, sadly, yeah. Beetlejuice, sadly, the guys who wrote Beetlejuice are dead. So, you know, we can't blame Tim Burton for not bringing back the two writers who have sadly passed away in the 40 years that have
if elapsed. Anyone could do it, Tim Burton could bring him back.
Yeah.
There's also the three thing. There's a sequel six sickness where a director can get, you know, beat up also. Like, you know, I have a little experience with, you know, a lot of the people that did the Fast and the Furious movies, and Fast and the Furious 5 was a great movie. It's the best of the series. The script was tight. It was great. It was where this, you know, for years, Fast and the Furious were car culture movies that had a heist element. Now this was a heist. This was a heist movie that had a car culture element. It found this like perfect balance, right? And it was very successful. It was this huge deal. And then Universal is like, oh my God, we got to fucking cash in now. Let's go. Let's six. And they never had the time to get the script right. They brought back everybody. They brought back all the right people, but all those people, they did not have the time. They did not have the space to work it out. And so what you had was you had Justin Lin shooting outline, basically. Like, the people are pages the morning of that kind of don't add up. It's like, don't worry about it. I'll fix it in post. Well, and Justin's like, hey, can we stop? And no, go, right? And so that is a big mess.
Sometimes it doesn't take that many movies. You know, the best example being Iron Man 2. John Favreau and Robert Downey Jr. convinced themselves that they could have improv the first movie. They couldn't have. They were not actually talented enough to improv a whole superhero movie by themselves. And they made a pretty terrible second movie that we are Feige is very lucky that did not crash the entire enterprise, but we had a good second Captain America movie on the way. And then we had a good Avengers movie. And then we had a bad second Thor movie, but more boring than a garbage fire like Iron Man 2 was. And it's just, you know, people get convinced, they get cocky and go, well, we laughed our way through the first movie, we'll do it through the second.
Well, yeah. Iron Man 2 was part of that. And the other thing that happened with Iron Man 2 is Feige and the Marvel Bros said, oh, wait, we have to set up everything else. You know that movie you guys were going to make? Here's a bucket of other shit you have to deal with. Fit it in somehow. And it ends up being a schizophrenic mess. And the funny like sort of epilogue to the Fast and the Furious story is they start shooting 7, and it is going to be as big as 5-6 was. And then tragically, Paul Walker dies. And then they are forced to stop the train. I mean, it was going so quickly and it was such a mess that Justin's like, I don't want anything to do with this. He takes a step back. Another director comes in, Paul dies. And then they're forced to stop and be like, oh no, we have shot half a movie with this guy who cannot finish the movie. How do we now make sense of all this? We have to use this footage. And then so there was an all stop, and meticulously brought everybody in and went through the fine tooth comb and made it all make sense. And when you watch that movie, it is kind of the tightest script in the entire series, because it had to be. And then it has the emotional punch of saying goodbye to Paul. But it's just such an interesting study and how we screw these things up, you know. And
well, it's a different industry, but I always remember Elvis Costello, international jewel thief Declan McManus, as he is also known, once said, you know, the sophomore slump on albums. He's like, if you're a rocker, it took you 19 years to write your first album. Really? You worked on it for 19 years and then they want another one in 6 months. And he's like, and guess what? It's never going to be as good as the one that was everything in your heart and soul for your entire life up until the moment you released that album. Cause you never think you're going to get a second album, just like you never think you're going to get a second movie. So you put everything into it. You know, I always like, you know, they did always leave things dangling for obvious reasons. But I remember reading an interview with Jonathan Nolan about Westworld. And they were like, were you setting up this? Were you setting up that? And he's like, every season, I assume we're never going to get a second season. And he's like, yeah, we leave dangling plot threads, but I'm trying to just slam it home every time. And, you know. And that way I can pretend to be pleasantly surprised when they ask us back. And he goes, okay, now we can follow that thing that I didn't fully develop in the last season. But you always kind of have to go like, no, what if we never get to do this again? You know, and it's an interesting thing. But yeah, ultimately what I was getting at there was just the obvious thing is the respect for the writer and what the writer does. And it is so rarely, it even fascinates me. You'll read, you know, culture articles that forget writers exist. And I always think, you know, you comics journalist, film journalist, whatever, you're a writer. How do you not value writing? How do you write an entire thing about an upcoming feature film and have nothing to say about the scriptwriter?
Totally agree with that. And I also think it's about respecting the audience, right? Mm-hmm. I think there is this sense that if the last movie made a ton of money, that the next movie will make a ton of money, and you don't have to respect the audience, right? And mm-hmm. give them something that's worth coming back for, right? It's that sequel mania of, if it worked the first time, it'll work. We'll throw it all together and it'll work again. Well, but no, because every movie is hard. This is the thing. Every script is hard. Every movie, every comic book is hard. It takes a lot of work to find out what is really going to come together. And if you try to do it quickly, or you just assume that it's going to make money without putting in the work, then you're disrespecting the audience as well. You're saying, I can pan this off on you and you're going to spend all your money on it. You know?
Yeah, there's a whole universe of films, and I'm always fascinated by this phenomenon where I will see a movie and just love it, think it's great, and then I see the trailer for the sequel and I go, I have actually zero interest in seeing this film. Like, you know, like you, Paramount, have talked me out of seeing another movie with these characters. Like, I was pretty excited about it, and now I'm like, you know, I'm good. I'm good. I don't need to go back to this world and see these people again. And it's that's also, but you're right about that. I always used to say, you know, making a good movie or making a good work of art of any kind, it's like hitting a home run. If you break it down into what it is, okay, a guy's going to stand 90 feet away from you. He's going to throw a ball at you 95 to 100 miles an hour. You're going to swing a stick that's 2 inches wide in an arc that's going to intersect the 95 mile an hour ball in such a way that it is going to be propelled 500 feet. That sounds like, tell a physicist that, and they're going to go, yeah, that's unlikely. And people do it 1,000 times a day. And to me, that's what making a movie is hitting a home run. And there are a lot of pop outs. There are a lot of ground balls into the infield that get you thrown out at first. And I have to say, I will see movies sometimes. Some bad movies scare the shit out of me because I just see a whole bunch of talented people and you're watching them and go, no disrespect. I think Spielberg is one of our most talented, but I've seen Spielberg movies where I go, no one was willing to tell Steven Spielberg this so transparently didn't work, that he had cast the wrong person, that this take on the material was the wrongest of all takes. You know, it's just, it's terrifying sometimes to see really talented people make something that's just, you just go, how did no one, how did this train get off the tracks right away and never get back on the track?
You know? And that's the most annoying thing is when something could have been, something should have been great and it's not. That is what enrages me. If it's bad, I don't give a shit. But if I'm watching something and I'm like, this could have been an A+ movie. This could have been like a movie that lasts, that we watch forever. And it is just garbage because people don't care, or somebody made a left turn when they should have made a right turn. It can go wrong very quickly.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I like the baseball analogy. I remember Kevin Youkilis. Do you remember Kevin Youkilis with Boston Red Sox? Mm. He said, you know, he'd come up to the plate and people would be screaming, hit a homer, Youk, hit a homer, Youk. They'd be like, it's not that easy. Every time I come up to the plate, I can't hit a homer, right? It's true. Like, you see these things, you see people.
Yeah, if it was easy, Hank Aaron would have hit five of them a game. But even, he didn't hit five of them a game.
Even for the best players, it's difficult, right? Yeah. And sometimes you take swings and misses.
That's the other thing. I would always rather see.
Right? You know, as long as someone's taking a good risk and they miss. That's one thing. But if it feels like it's lazy or phoned in or whatever, that's where I get annoyed, right? But if someone just goes for it and they miss, at least they went for it, right?
Yeah, I won't name names on the negative side, but I'd rather see David Cronenberg's worst movie than a couple of other people's most mediocre movie. Because when I'm sitting in a Cronenberg movie, I'm all like, he is going to play by his own rules. He's going to do the thing that he thinks is the best thing. And his heart and soul is in it. And if it doesn't work, it's not that he wasn't trying to do something new and interesting. It's that he went down a road that was an unprofitable road. And that we all do that sometimes.
That's okay, right? It's like this was never going to work in a million years, but man, did this person go for it, right? I mean, that is amazing to watch sometimes.
To name, always smart, right?
To name names, you know, it's like, I think J.J. Abrams is a talented director. As a writer, half of his films, I think I could have given you a half a page of notes that would have made this go from a 6 to a 9. Easy things, simple. You never look at a bad Cronenberg movie and go, oh, this was easy to fix. It's like, no. That was impossible to fix. That was choices were made. He wanted to do a thing that was never going to work, but it was the thing he wanted to do. And you could not have said, no, David, if you just adjust this character's one motivation, this thing will make a lot more sense. Not really. that's not how he's making movies, you know? So you got to appreciate that. There are no notes you could give the Coen brothers where they would go, oh yeah, that would work
better. I was going to say, I use the Coen brothers in that same example as David Cronenberg. I would watch the worst Coen brothers movie over most people's best movies because they are, you know, always up, you know, it'd be interesting to see, you know, lately they haven't done much, but through a long career from the 1980s on, they were always the smartest, most thoughtful, most interesting,
And those are the people that you trust and you come back to again and again. And there, you know, I remember, you know, there are artists and writers in comics that I feel the same way about, that I will read their noble failure, and be more interested in it than, just some boilerplate superhero thing, you know, that anybody could write. You know, I'd rather see the big swings, you know, and the people who take the big swings tend to be overhated.
Of course. Yeah. I think that goes.
I used to look at, you know, Comic Book Roundup is where they have all the reviews. And I would see like one bad review on there and I would get, you know, upset about it. I'd never read them. You can see the number value that they put on it. But it's like, you want to feel good about yourself as a comics writer, go look at, you know, some genius comics writer's profile on Comic Book Roundup. You know, go look up Mark Waid, and he has a career average of 6.0, because there are a lot of people out there that are going to write 1.0 reviews of him, no matter what the hell he does, because they just fucking hate him, you know, in a way that there aren't that many people who hate me. I haven't had the kind of career to attract those kind of haters, because I haven't done something with a character they love that made them angry for the rest of their lives. you look up Kurt Busiek. He's got a lifetime of 6.0. I'm like, he has never written a comic that wasn't an 8.0 in his entire career. Like, that's his worst thing is very, very good. But there are people out there giving him ones and twos because they just hate him. And the more famous you are, the more there are people who are just going to give you zero stars for whatever you do. And so it gets easy to let go of that and just do the work. You know,
I think that's it. You always
John Layman has a, John Layman has a comic book roundup stalker. Yeah, it's like the day that everything comes up, this person goes on and just gives it a one.
Right. But that's not a reviewer. That's like a user review, I think.
Well, sure, but you go on Comic Book Roundup and you have a critic score and you have a user score, and there's somebody that dislikes John Layman for whatever reason so much that the day that every single one of it's been going on for years, the day every single one of his books comes out, the guy goes on and gives him a one and talks about how it's garbage.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and it's like if you want for yourself, it's tiny minority of fan culture that's just completely out of its mind. And there's just nothing. I made fun of Comicsgate in a issue of Elvira, and some dude on YouTube who had a YouTube comics review thing, I think because I like what I called the guy used the noun geek. I think the character was Geek Bully, and I think the guy's handle on YouTube had geek in it. He made four videos about how obsessed I am with him and how I hated him. I didn't know the guy existed. He thought the character was drawn to look like him. It was drawn to look like Ethan Van Sciver, but all those guys look the same. it was an overweight gentleman with a scrubby beard and a little fedora. And it's like, that could be a lot of guys. But four videos about how I was obsessed with him. And it's just, what are you going to do? Like, there was a minute where if you Googled me, like the video section was three of those videos. And now, 100 some episodes of this podcast later, there's no way his three videos are ever going to bob to the surface again. But it's just the funniest fucking thing that people get these like very personal parasocial relationships with you, based on the work. And it's like nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, I agree. I have not had that. Haven't had any level of success.
Congratulations.
That there. Congratulations. And also congratulations for being obscure. I think about someone like George Lucas, and just like all the hate, it's like at the end of the day, you just got to be like, I don't know. I'm just trying to tell a story,
I'm not trying to
offend anybody. I'm trying to do, I'm trying to write a story. That's what I'm trying to do, at the end of the day.
I used to get a little more upset about in the social media world, like in the Twitter world. But I've noted, over time, it sort of penetrates your head that it's like, if I have 10,000 likes on a tweet and there are five replies and three of them are negative, I think I'm just going to go with the 10,000 people who I think I owe it to the 10,000 people who clicked like to ignore the three guys that are mad. What I mean? Like, I think I'll take their word for it that it's good and just get on with my life and
that's
not
0.003%.
Yeah. And that's sort of what you got to look, but there are people there are people far more successful, far more prominent and famous, like David Simon, who created The Wire, will every once in a while just take some time out of his busy day to rip some poor troll's head off and shit down his neck as violently as humanly possible. And it's a hell of a thing to watch a writer that good do to a guy who is, barely verbal. So it's kind of a funny thing to observe, but anyway,
the critic thing is so funny because you go on Rotten Tomatoes and Shank has a 99% or whatever, and there's the one guy that was like, oh man, this is terrible, like I couldn't get through it, just spitting venom about it, and literally every other critic in the entire universe. And it's gotten, it's gotten worse over time because, this stuff piles up over time. People started to recognize it as, one of the best films ever and blah, 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 blah. And there's still that one guy. And it was funny because Roger Ebert, like historically had some really bad misses on things where he would watch a movie the first time and he would give it, 1.5 stars or something like that. Just beat up. Oh yeah, I didn't get it. It was Trump. It was the other thing. And then history, the machine would be like, oh wow, this is a really great movie. This is a classic movie. And then Raj would go back and would edit his review, online, and it would be a 3.5-star review. And he would talk about and who knows. And that, bit shady, but also maybe he just watched it again and he finally got it.
I always prefer the honesty of saying I was wrong the first time, or I had a different perspective on it.
And especially if you're reviewing and watching 6, 7, 8 movies a week, sometimes you're just not going to be in the right place for something to come in, right? I mean, I've done that too. I've gone back and watched movies that I didn't like, and then really appreciated them as I've gotten older, And I was like, what was I thinking last time? But my opinion, 20 years ago was strong, and now it's.
But totally there is also that thing that happens where when someone who is thought to be talented makes a bad movie, they have armor, and there are people that are just never going to see it with clear eyes. They're always. When I walked out of Seven, the day that I saw it, which is a very well-made movie, it's very good, I turned to my best friend who was with me at the time and said, the only terrible thing about this movie is for the rest of my life, people are going to tell me that Alien 3 is a misunderstood classic. I was like, I saw Seven on opening day, and I said, yesterday, Alien 3 was a terrible disaster that no one should ever watch again. It just became a misunderstood gem for the rest of our lives, and nothing will ever change that. Like, because now this guy is going to be an anointed genius, and we will not be allowed to dislike anything he has ever done. And that's where we're at. And I think that, public consensus, I've told this story before, but in college, I saw the Bond film Never Say Never Again came out, the off-brand Bond film. And Richard Schickel in Time magazine gave it a glowing review and said, one of the best film in the series since From Russia with Love. And because I was in college at the time, I had access to a large library with a periodical room. And I went to the periodical room and I found the 1964 issue of Time magazine in which Richard Schickel reviewed From Russia with Love. He called it so bad that it borders on self-parody.
There you go.
In the fullness of time, people had convinced Richard, the culture had moved on from thinking James Bond movies from the 60s were silly. We're back to thinking they're silly again, by the way. But in the 80s, From Russia with Love was the best movie in the series and a classic and a serious espionage movie and all that. And I don't know if Richard had forgotten his initial or if he watched it again on TV in the 70s and went, this thing's pretty good. But
I grew up with Roger Moore and Moonraker, and they were really truly silly.
Yeah,
it was actually kind of fun to go back and watch the earlier ones and be like, oh, wait a minute, these were not so absurd.
Yeah,
way back when. But in the 80s, particularly, they got really silly.
But I think ultimately, I was going to say, just ultimately, your relationship to anything can change over time, and that's fine and that's fair. Yeah. And there's no such thing. I don't believe there's such a thing as a wrong opinion on a movie. Things work for you where they don't. And you don't have to agree with everybody. It's fine.
As long as someone's coming from an honest place as opposed to having an
accident. It's the honest place. Yeah.
They honestly look at it and say, I didn't like this. Fine. But if they've got, if they're grinding,
but, yeah, yeah.
Whatever, different thing.
Yeah. We are obsessed with eviscerating things right now. And I think Twitter culture has, like, you know, has sort of, you know, melded with the critique community, and it has become something different and something evil and something awful. And now anybody can be a critic, and it's just I just question all of it. I just like, why do we have to put some of the shit into the world? You know what I'm saying? It's like we only have so much time. We only have so much bandwidth, and you go to the comic shop and you pick up 10 books and you read them, and some of them are probably pretty damn good, right? And then you go to your computer and you could spend an hour writing an article about one of those books that you loved and why you loved it and why somebody should pick that up, and it makes the whole business go, and instead there are people who, well, I'm going to spend that hour instead trashing the one of the 10 books that I didn't like, and dumping all over, you know, I mean, somebody spent, I mean, how many months and writing it, how many dollars went into that? How much blood, sweat, and tears, how much of somebody's heart and soul is into that thing? You know, and then some Ron, who's drinking too much at home, takes an hour of his life to trash it. Even if it is bad, I don't understand why it's worth spending an hour writing about why it's bad.
Well, I take the hour. Like, he's like, why do people trash things? I'm like, because you get more likes. Unfortunately, it's just kind of human nature. Yeah. If you're trying to make a presence online, you're chasing the likes. And if you come out and say, "Hey, I really liked this," versus "This is trash," you're going to get more of a reaction to "This is trash" every time. I don't know why.
The funniest thing with comics to me is because of people's, you know, weird slavish devotion to the characters that they grew up with and then they love, you will get someone who says that Gail Simone's the worst writer in comics and they hate her more than anything in the world. They have read everything she's ever written. And I'm like, you know, why didn't you, you could stop buying these. You don't actually, like, it's wild that you're going to the comic book store and saying, give me all the Gail Simone. And it's like, no, like when I discover I dislike a writer or an artist, I never read anything that they do again. Like, if they get my favorite character of all time, I am, you know, I have a favorite Marvel Comics character, and there is a very popular writer who has written him badly over and over again since the 80s. I do not bother buying those comics. Yeah. I am not interested in that writer's take on the character. I know I will read an issue and go, no, this is terrible. Sometimes in a store, I will look at page one and go, nope, still the same take. Hasn't learned, hasn't grown up, not interested in reading it. And the people who are like, you know, Tom King's run on Batman was terrible. I'm like, well, how do you know? Did you actually keep reading after the first Tom King Batman issue? Oh, yeah, no, I read all of them. I was like, that was 3 years, man. What the hell? Like, you read 3 years of Batman and Catwoman comics out of hatred? You spent $500 on Tom King. Are you aware of that? Like, that's some wild shit. I'm sure Tom really appreciates the $500 you gave Marvel or DC Comics to read these comics that you hated so much. I'll never get it. I'll never understand it. But we should wrap up pretty soon. But Sean, what is coming out to the public next? What can they expect to see from you next?
Let's see. So September 25th, The Killing Machine 3 and Woodstake number 2. Okay. Great covers on both of them. Killing Machine, like you said, it's a thinking man sci-fi. It does take like two or three issues for the scope of the story to come out. So I really hope people are in for 3. And then we just continue one a month until those series are done. And then next year it's going to be about Aerotech and another series.
Nice. What are the runs on, how many issues do those two series run?
Killing Machine is 5 and Woodstake is 6 with the prologue. Okay. Yeah.
Great. Cool. And are you looking at trade paperbacks for those, or is that still too far out?
Nope. Definitely looking at trade paperbacks. Yeah. Okay. So trying to get these stories out there. The floppies are hard, like you said. And also as a new publisher, you know, people are just finding out about us. And already we've got, you know, 3 and 4 in the Diamond catalog, you know, previews world right now. So already, you know, people that don't even know about us have missed the boat a little bit on the early floppies. So
sure,
we're definitely gonna, I mean, if we're getting close to selling out on Woodstake prologue, the first run. So we may, you know, do a second printing of that, but I think the trades will be a great way to get the stories out there.
Sure. And Rylan, what you got coming up next? The Breach, right?
The Breach. Yeah. I am at Rylan Grant on all forms of social media. That is Rylan Grant. If you're just listening, most of you are. I always spell it because it's not a real name. My parents sort of arrange letters and saddled me with it. So now I have to spell it for you. But yeah, check out my social media. You'll see all the details on that stuff. But yeah, The Breach is the pre-launch page, COVID brain is having trouble. The pre-launch page for The Breach is up on Kickstarter right now. So, so pop on over there. If you you check out my Twitter, my Instagram, or whatever, you'll be able to do it. And you can follow that. It launches September 23rd. You'll be able to get that thing. And then also news that I didn't cover in the opening is that it looks like Haunted Heart will be out in the United States at the end of September also. That is my thriller that it's a film. My COVID brain is having a hard time right now, but it is a film directed by Academy Award winner Fernando Chureba, starring Matt Dillon and Ida Fulch and a bunch of other great people. It's kind of a paranoid thriller that takes place on Greek island. Really beautiful, really dark, really twisted, really great. You're gonna love it. I think it's in theaters in the United States and on VOD at the same time with our crazy like modeling that's happening right now on September 27th. So check that out. I'm excited for everyone to see it. It's a good one, so go watch it. But yeah, bring us home. I'm living across the finish line here.
I understand. For now, what's out in stores is Drawing Blood, issue 6 coming at the end of the month. Trade paperback of number 1 coming soon, and the trade paperback has a lot of extras in it. It has the in-universe, all of the in-universe comics that we've made for it, including the radically rearranged Ronin Ragdoll, say that 4 times fast, which is our Turtles pastiche, which is a great deal of fun, 32-page origin issue. And that'll be in, I just got the sales reports, that'll be in a lot of bookstores, not just comic book stores, which makes me very happy. We have a deal with Simon & Schuster for those. So that's going well. And you could, particularly if you have a kid under the age of 10, you should watch Batwheels, a TV show that I write for. It's on Max and on Netflix. And con appearances, Granite State, then at Arsenal Comics and Games, and then at LA Comic Con, which is where I will be for 3 blistering days. Bring me a soft pretzel and I'll be your friend forever. And that's it. Thank you for joining us for this episode of The Writer's Block. Sean, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Thank you for having me. It was great. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening, guys.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.